American 11, are you trying to call?
The cockpit is not answering your phone.
Our number one is in staff, and our five is in staff.
Hey, I'm going to call from Washington. I have a situation with American 11, a possible hijack.
What's going on, Benny? The craft is erratic again. Problems are erratic.
Eddie,
talk to me. Eddie,
are you there?
The plane
is at 737.
It what?
The
737.
It what?
The World Trade Center.
Who are you
talking to? Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
A-175, New York. We have some problems over here right now. We might have a hijack over here, two of them.
Jules, this is Ryan. Listen, on an airplane that's been hijacked. If things don't go well, I'm looking good.
What are those people going to do? All the elevators are blocked out.
Oh, my God. So both towers are now.
Okay. I got an aircraft southeast of the White House.
Hello? Crystal City, just north of Crystal City.
Just to the north of your town.
Yeah, stop all departures.
You can see the black smoke billowing out of the side of the Pentagon. It continues to billow out and cover much of the skyline here along the area, drifting along the Potomac River, casting a haze all over the Pentagon area.
It didn't look like there was a plane at all. It was just obliterated when it hit the ground.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV and covert operations, secret even in success. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji and this is The Big Picture. September 11, 2001, 20 years ago today, in the United States of America, there was a horrible attack on the Twin Pillars. Yes, you heard me correctly. The Twin Pillars, not Twin Towers. The Twin Pillars of Truth and Justice were brought down, attacked and demolished. Big lies were manufactured about the 9/11 attacks. Big lies about why Afghanistan had to be bombed and invaded. And big lies about why Iraq had to be bombed and invaded. And big lies to kidnap and torture innocent men at Guantanamo Bay. And when the big lies were exposed, there was no justice for those who suffered. The war criminals, the murderers were free to roam the earth as heroes and statesmen. And we were told the world changed forever after 9/11. Well, as the Americans say, it ain't over till it's over. And so what happened 20 years ago ain't over yet. The question mark still remained over the catastrophic event. And very soon, the can of worms is set to open. Who really carried out the attacks and why? There was a commission set up to examine what happened on September 11th, known as the 9/11 Commission. It produced a wishy-washy report of which 28 pages were not disclosed to the public. It was regarded as secret, classified. The families of those who died, known as the 9/11 families, wanted the 28 pages to be released. So they went to court. The court said, release them. Obama vetoed the court's decision, but the U.S. Congress overrode Obama and said, release the 28 pages. Startling information was revealed. startling. This is from CNN News yesterday. The long classified documents confirmed that some of the 9/11 hijackers had been in contact with and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They included the stunning revelation that the phone numbers of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who was then Saudi ambassador to the United States, was in the phone book of Abu Zubaydah, who is currently held at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay and was an associate of bin Laden. In addition to Bandar's number, Zubaydah had the unlisted number of a guard who worked at the Saudi embassy in the United States. The 28 pages also describe Bandar's financial support for a man, Osama Basnan, who had been in contact with two of the hijackers. And so, dear listeners, the plot thickens. The 9/11 families are at this time pursuing a court case against Saudi Arabia to find out what is this all about. As I said, it would open up a huge can of worms. Huge can of worms. I call it the politics of unintended consequences. Could the big boys in Saudi Arabia be behind the 9/11 attacks? Could Bandar have bankrolled the whole project? Could they have set up this whole thing with Mossad? Could the U.S. have colluded with Israel and Saudi Arabia to make this an inside job? These questions just don't go away. And the question marks were there right from the time that the Twin Towers collapsed. They have been dismissed by the U.S. government and its ever-willing allies, the mainstream media, as big conspiracy theories, made-up stories, they say, the product of a fertile imagination. Well, let me put it this way. If out of the 20 such claims that point to 9/11 as an inside job, if just 4 or 5 are proved to be true, then we must, yes, we must conclude that the story that 19 Saudi hijackers armed with box cutters were sent on a mission by a man in a cave in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden, that it is a huge, elaborate hoax. That's what you have to conclude. A colossal lie. The George Bush, this was not, well, George Bush announced that this is a war on terror. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. Black and white, finish and klar. Khalas. It was not a war on terror. It was a war of terror, also known as endless war. Well, here are some of the main points that people question about the September 11th attacks. Right. The so-called alleged devout Muslim hijackers drank heavily, frequented strip clubs and paid prostitutes. Ah, and of course, one of them forgot a copy of the Quran in the pub. How careless, eh? How careless. How careless. We were told that people on the planes called their families to say goodbye. Well, technology in 2001 made cell phone calls above 30,000 feet impossible. The FBI falsely claimed Mohammed Attar's luggage left behind contained, in its words, decisive evidence about Al-Qaeda's responsibility for the attacks. Passports allegedly found at United 93, that's the plane's crash site, were fake and actually survived the fiery fall of the towers. FBI most wanted poster does not state that bin Laden is wanted for 9/11. No Arab names on passenger list released by Associated Press on 9/17/01. BBC on the 23rd of September 01 said hijack suspects alive and well. The Transportation Secretary, Norman Mineta, said Dick Cheney apparently confirmed a stand-down order prior to an alleged plane striking the Pentagon, meaning that he said that U.S. fighter jets must not take off and intercept the planes heading to the Twin Towers. The 9/11 Whitewash Commission deleted Mineta's comments from its official report. The BBC reported Building 7's collapse 30 minutes before it actually came down, clearly having advanced word on what was coming to be on the scene, to report. Hundreds of highly qualified physicists, chemists, architects, engineers, pilots, former military officers and former intelligence officials rejected the 9/11 myth. None, none of the indestructible black boxes that record what happens on the planes were found. None of them were found. About the plane that is said to have crashed into the Pentagon, Fire Chief Ploger said there's no fuselage sections and that sort of stuff. Reporters were threatened or, in fact, handcuffed and dragged away. No video of Boeing 757 striking the Pentagon because the cameras were strangely switched off. CNN reporter James McIntyre said, from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. Lieutenant Robert Medeiros, watch commander for the day, said, I didn't see any pieces of any plane, and I couldn't believe a plane hit the building. But wait, just wait a minute. Hang on, Habibi, hang on. Let's say that all of the above is mere speculation, meaning that it may be true or maybe not. But there's one very, very striking fact that is not in dispute. And I'm going to be as brief as possible in unpacking it. George Bush, he was from the Republican Party, became president in 2001. A few years before that, in 1997, a group was formed, and it called itself Project for a New American Century. This was a group, all Republican, from the Republican Party, and they were described as neoconservatives, or we can call them warmongers, who hatched a plan to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Again, 1997. And so the leaders of this group were Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Paul Wolfowitz. They sent this plan to Bill Clinton, who was at that time the president. Of course, he was a Democrat, and he was not keen on moving with the plan. So they waited for Bush to be elected president in 2001, and predicted that their plan will only work if something very big like Pearl Harbor would happen in America before the nation will be united to wage war. So what was Pearl Harbor? Well, very briefly, America was not involved in the Second World War until something big happened, and that big thing was Pearl Harbor. Nazi Germany and Japan were on the same side in the war. On December 7, 1941, Japanese fighter jets attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, known as Pearl Harbor, for 2 hours. 21 U.S. ships were sunk or damaged. 188 U.S. aircrafts were destroyed. And 2,403 Americans were killed. Ish. That was huge, huge. Next day, the U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt declared war on Japan. Right, let me see where I am now. I'm just trying to get the number of a guest that we're going to be having very soon, and I'm giving that to the studio guys here. Sorry about that little break there. Right. So, next day, as I said, U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt declared war on Japan. So when we speak about these guys, we regard them, as I told you, as the neocons. And they were looking for something big to happen, and it happened. And so we had another Pearl Harbor on September 11th, 9/11. Bush was president. All the rogues were in his cabinet. Dick Cheney was vice president. Donald Rumsfeld was defense secretary. Paul Wolfowitz was the deputy defense secretary. And hear this. Where are we now? On the morning of 12th September 2001, without any evidence of who the hijackers were, Rumsfeld demanded that the U.S. attack Iraq. Rumsfeld told a cabinet meeting that Iraq should be a principal target of the first round in the war against terrorism. Iraq was temporarily spared only because Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, persuaded Bush that public opinion has to be prepared before a move against Iraq is possible. Afghanistan was chosen as the softer option. Some 20,000 people in Afghanistan paid the price of this debate with their lives. Of course, Afghanistan could not just be attacked for no reason. And so the reason, the excuse was created. Osama bin Laden, head of Al-Qaeda, was in Afghanistan and he plotted the whole thing. He plotted the whole thing and sent the hijackers to attack America. Wonderful, wonderful. So get this, the FBI did admit in its words that it had no hard evidence. No hard evidence. I'm just trying to figure out how I can get, without my guest, I won't have much of a program. Let me just see what's happening here. I'm sending a message to my guest, very important guest. Right. It's going to be a disaster, I can see that. Right, as I said, Afghanistan could not be attacked and Osama bin Laden was fingered. And so they had a wonderful manufactured excuse. Now get this. The FBI did admit, and in its own words, that it had no hard evidence connecting 9/11 to bin Laden or other Arabs. But that didn't matter. That didn't matter. And so the U.S. bombed and invaded Afghanistan and at the same time prepared for war against Iraq. Prepared meaning manufactured big lies that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and was a threat to the whole world and had to be sorted out. So George Bush and his pet, he had a pet, Tony Blair, useless, the poodle, joined forces to make war. In America, the people were largely behind Bush. But in Britain, there was a huge anti-war movement. And a leading voice was that of George Galloway, who was a Labour Party member of Parliament. I'm just going to take a short break now and see if I can get hold of George Galloway. I nearly say George Bush. We'll take a short break and get back to you in a minute or two, inshallah. Right, welcome back to the Big Picture program. Sorry for that break. We were just trying to get our guest online. And as I said, in America, the people were largely behind Bush. But in Britain, there was a huge anti-war movement. A leading voice was that of George Galloway, who was a Labour Party member of Parliament. He was vice president of the Stop the War Coalition. Well, to say that he was outspoken is an understatement. He was a one-man weapon of mass destruction, shooting down the big lies of Bush and Blair. But let me share with you some personal tidbits. George Galloway was in Durban a few years ago on a speaking tour of South Africa, and he was brought by a Cape Town organization. So after a talk he gave here, I was invited by two of the organizers to have supper at a restaurant. And with, of course, George Galloway. The two brothers had to catch a plane or something like that, and they asked me if I could drop George off at his accommodation. Of course, I agreed. And along the way, we got chatting and chatting and chatting and so on. We reached his place in Berea. It was a beautiful evening, and there was a good view of Durban, and so we just stood outside there, and for some reason, we discussed something about songs from way, way back. And then both of us, we started singing a Frank Sinatra song. And the dogs began howling and people were opening the windows and shouting. It was great fun and I won't forget it. I wonder if George remembers it. Well, let me ask him. George Galloway, it's a great pleasure to have you on the Big Picture Show. Habibi, welcome and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I remember it absolutely clearly. I don't know if you do, I even remember the Sinatra song that we sang. Dogs of Durban.
Okay, so at the count of three, let's see if we've got a chance to make it on the South African pop idols. Let's see if you remember the song. Here we go. One, two, three. Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'll be sharing love before the night was through? Something in your eyes was so inviting. Something in your smile was so exciting. Something in my heart told me I must have you.
That's exactly right. But we're older now. We're
more lucky. George, that was wonderful. But I have to tell you, you're not my type, eh? Okay.
No, you mind.
All right, let's get serious, George.
We could reprise that night on the radio. I hope all the listeners have not switched off that chorus.
Right, George, you know, you were tireless in speaking out, as I mentioned earlier, against the war on Iraq. Tell us why, and also why you were attacked by some in the media, and especially phony Blair.
Well, I've always been opposed to imperialism. I come from an Irish background, so we knew a thing or two from the cradle and until the grave about imperialism. So I've always hated it. But as it happens, I was one of the only British parliamentarians that actually knew firsthand the truth about Iraq. I knew the mass destruction of the economic sanctions that were killing Iraqi children before they even knew that they were Iraqis. They were dead for no other reason than that they were Iraqis. But I also knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. So what could I do? I was a Labour Member of Parliament, and the Labour leader, Prime Minister, was blatantly lying about things I knew to be lies. So, as a man of conscience, what could I do except speak out clearly and loudly and accurately and with some effect, I think. And that's what got me kicked out of the Labour Party. But 20 years almost on, 20 years from 9/11, getting on for 20 years from the war, everybody knows that I was right and you were right and all the millions who marched were right. It was the people who ruled us that were the liars. And those that weren't liars were fools that were following the liars. And those who were reviled, I tell you, for speaking the truth, are now wholly vindicated. So I thank God for that I lived long enough to see that vindication. You know, in the past, one would be long dead before one was absolved by history. But things move at quite a pace nowadays.
Indeed. And American politicians were also upset with you, and you went over to the U.S. Congress and delivered some pretty hard kicks up their backsides, which left them quite speechless. What was all that about?
Well, speaking the truth in the court of the Sultan is a high honor. It's also a high responsibility if one can do it, and I had that opportunity to do it. The United States, flush with victory, they thought, in Afghanistan and then Iraq, was hunting down those who had stood against them, and amongst those were the foreign minister of France, the cheese-eating surrender monkeys, you'll recall. They were called in the U.S. media, the secretary to Nelson Mandela, the secretary to the Pope, and me. But they made a very big mistake, as George Bush might put it. They misunderestimated me. And when I got up close and personal with them, in the U.S. Senate. I delivered them a lesson by the grace of God, and it's a lesson that has lasted. It's still watched by millions of people today online. You can check it out. It is my greatest hit so far. I'm hoping there'll be a better day to come, but it was definitely my best day so far.
Yes, and that video has gone viral here also, even recently. Yes. Now, there were no consequences when it was discovered that the weapons of mass destruction story was a big lie. What's your views about that?
Well, I think you used the word correctly. It was a lie. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't faulty intelligence. It was a carefully calculated lie. And moreover, one made in England, because entering the war alongside George Bush would have been illegal under British law, never mind international law, which the whole thing was. But it was a crime under British law unless there were weapons of mass destruction. And so the government of Tony Blair invented them as a willful act of lying. And I've just made a film called Killing Kelly, which you can get now on Amazon, on Vimeo, and so on, about the strange death of the weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly, who had begun to go rogue and began telling BBC journalists and others that the story about weapons of mass destruction was indeed a lie. And he was well-placed to know that as Britain's most senior weapons inspector. And lo and behold, a few days, literally hours after telling the British Parliament about these things, he was found dead in the woods, as he had earlier predicted that he would be. And I've made a movie about it, and if you watch it, you won't be in any doubt at the end that David Kelly didn't commit suicide. So he was one of millions of victims of the Iraq War, which was based on a pack of lies. And yet the people responsible for these lies, for this disaster, which is still playing out yet, of course, the whole ISIS phenomenon, the whole surge of Al-Qaeda and so on, is intimately connected to this Iraq war, were not only not punished for what they did, they were rewarded. They've all been promoted. They've all become filthy rich on the back of the crime that they committed. So I see it as my duty, as long as God gives me breath, to pursue these people. And after me, my sons. Mashallah, I have many children, and all of them are committed to continuing this work. Because if there's no accountability for crimes of this magnitude, why shouldn't rulers in the future commit these crimes over and over again?
Indeed. George, we are told repeatedly that after 9/11, the world changed forever. Does that mean the U.S. is still in a strong position to carry on what's described as forever wars, or have things changed dramatically?
Well, the Iraq war was in part mounted to demonstrate the invincibility of the United States, and it ended up proving exactly the opposite. When the United States scuttled out of Iraq under fire, it emboldened people all over the world to stand up to them. And we've just seen in the extraordinary events in Afghanistan the limits of American power. So that which was designed to show the absolute dominance, hegemony of the United States empire actually proved the opposite. And we have now emerged from a historically brief, though long in the lifetime of one man, a period of unipolar power. We're now back in a multilateral, multipolar world. And therefore, the future will not be as the immediate past has been. The United States writ no longer runs in the world. They're not a paper tiger. They're still a tiger. But they're an old tiger whose teeth have begun to fall out. And moreover, there are new tigers in the jungle.
Right, George, the so-called war on terror largely targeted Muslim countries and generally Muslim organizations and, of course, individuals who ended up in Guantanamo. Do you see any shift in the response of Muslims in challenging this demonization, maybe even via the U.S. political system? And together with that, is the writing on the wall for the tin pot dictators in the Middle East, or is the so-called Arab Spring dead in the water?
Well, I wish I could answer you in the affirmative on that latter point, but I can't. I can just reiterate the point I just made, that whilst long in the lifetime of those of us who are in this life, historically, this period is short, and the dictators all will fall in time. They won't necessarily be replaced by better, but the status quo cannot prevail forever. All empires must fall, all dictators must fall, and that goes for the Arab dictators also. As for the Muslim Ummah, its power is almost limitless. 2 billion people stretched across the world, and indeed occupying some of the most economic and politically, strategically important places on the globe. If the Muslims were united, there is nothing that they could not achieve. But they're a long, long way from being united. And, of course, in many places seem rather keen to slaughter each other for the interests of and sometimes the entertainment of the others. So I'd be a liar if I said to you I was optimistic in this historical period, but in the longer term, I believe that that humanity will emerge and come to fruition as God intended it to.
Right. To move the subject, you are a great supporter of the Palestinians. Do you think that Israel's move to the far right will eventually lead to its implosion?
Again, I wouldn't predict that because predictions have long and often been confounded. But I think we can track the bankruptcy of the Zionist ideology to where we are today with a far-right government and a far-right opposition. Nobody moves in support of Israel now out of love, but merely out of interest. Now, those interests still prevail, but interests change. And Mr. Ghani just saw what happens when the American state no longer considers you to be in their interests, as the Shah of Persia found before them and many others have found. So nobody is defending Zionism, defending Israel, because it's a beautiful thing, because they love it, because they can even justify it, but merely out of interest. And as I say, interests will change. The Palestinian people have refused to go into the Museum of Ex-Peoples, and they're not going to do so now. And we see every day in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, the fortitude of these remarkable people, one of the most remarkable in modern human history, who have had everything, including the kitchen sink, thrown at them, and moreover been slandered on top of all the physical injury and disinheritance that they have suffered. They have had the insult added to injury that they are somehow the terrorists rather than being, in fact, the victims of terrorism. So the Palestinian people will not be cancelled. They will not disappear. And as long as that's true, there will be millions, hundreds of millions around the world who stand with them. We cannot go to their side. We cannot fight with them or for them. But we will do everything in our power through boycott, divestment, sanctions, and simple acts of solidarity to be with them. I no longer believe that at my age I will walk in a free Palestine, but there's every likelihood that my children will do.
Inshallah. George, just a final point, and this is a very important one. Do you have any political ambitions, maybe replace Prime Minister Boring Johnson?
I think it's probably too late for that. And I never had political ambitions. My ambition was only to be active and as influential as I could be on the issues that mattered most to me. Now, I'm in the car, headed for a public event in Leicester. I have another in London after that. I'm on television 7 days a week, literally. I have 6 children. I have followers in the millions. So I can say that my efforts have been as successful as was possible in these days. I even once gave my blood on the floor of the Guguletu police station during the apartheid era. But that's another story.
Hmm. George, when you get to these meetings, please pass on our greetings of solidarity to the people that you'll be speaking to. And George Galloway, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the Big Picture program. Thank you so much for the interview, and I hope to be singing with you once again very soon, inshallah.
Inshallah, inshallah. Bye now.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Well, there you are. Effervescent as always, that's George Galloway. Let me finish the topic of 9/11 with these words. Morgan O. Reynolds was appointed by George W. Bush as chief economist at the Labor Department. He left in 2002 and doesn't think much of his former boss. He describes President Bush as, in his words, dysfunctional creep, not to mention a possible war criminal. When asked by a journalist about his views on 9/11, he answered, this is his answer, who did it? Elements of our government and M16 and the Mossad. The government's case is a laugh-out-loud proposition. They use patsies and lies and subterfuge, and there's no way that Bush and Cheney could have invaded Iraq without the help of 9/11. All right, let me see what else I can get through in this last 2 or 3 minutes that I have left. Right, and now let's look at the shenanigans in the Banana Republic of South Africa. Dear listeners, I'm going to take a very important resolution to Parliament. I want all those who are locked up in prisons all over South Africa to be examined by doctors to see if they are stable. And if those that are found to be stable, well, they should be released immediately. So what do you think of that, Brazo? It's quite simple, really. If Yakubai was found to be stable, by the parole medical board, and should remain in Tronk, and then this was overruled by Zuma's chommy, that's Arthur Frazier, the Director General of Correctional Services, then why not apply this to the rest of the criminals in jail? It's logical, isn't it? Well, of course, I'm joking. But, this whole Zuma thing has been a joke all along. Here's the newspaper headline for September 2030. 8:30. Jacob Zuma's lawyer, Dalimpofu, has asked for the prosecutor and the judge in the trial to be removed and for the whole judicial system, including the Constitutional Court, to be disbanded before Zuma will agree to appear in court. Right? And I think we just have to end it. Well, Zuma made Fraser Director General of the State Security Agency in 2016. Information surfaced that alleged that Fraser was involved in corruption regarding 1 billion rand of state security money. When Ramaphosa came in, he moved Fraser to head correctional services. And as head, he has the legal right to veto the decisions of the parole board, which is what he did. And so he saved Zuma for the second time. And he said this very boldly. Why? Because he doesn't have to worry about his job, because his contract expires shortly. What a mess. So blame also rests with Ramaphosa for giving a top job to a person with the cloud of corruption hanging over his head. And much of this came out at the Zondo Commission. As I said last week, Ramaphosa has kept many shady characters in his cabinet so as to strengthen his support base. It's all about politics, Habibi. It's all about politics. I was going to play you a clip now, but we've run out of time. And there is no time also for light at the end of the tunnel. And this is A.B. Dawji greeting you with Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.